Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm recording this on Monday, September 26th, but it's going to go to air on Tuesday, September 27th, because, of course, tonight is the very first U.S. presidential debate, and I don't think anybody's going to be listening to my show so long as that entertaining spectacle is on air. I'm really excited about the episode this week. A couple weeks prior, I was able to sit down with Kishore Hari, who is the director of the Bay Area Science Festival, among other great credentials, which we'll get to. But before we jump into that episode, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Now, remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And the way I'm able to keep on trucking is because of support by listeners like you. I want to thank those of you who have visited www.com. Nope. See, that's what happens when you're trying to read something while you talk. www.patreon.com/talknerdy and pledged your support. And this week, our top patrons are, come on, load. There we go. Phil T-Bear, Pedro Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and last but absolutely not least, Jeffrey Sewell. All right. So as I mentioned, I'm also supposed to I'm really bad about doing this. If you visit my website, carasanmaria.com, and you click through to the store, there's all sorts of great goodies, t-shirts, really beautiful hand-thrown mugs by H.P. Bloomer, an incredible potter, and also some beautiful hand-tooled bookmarks and keychains out of leather by Foster Leathercraft. Okay, great chat this week with Kishore Hari. He is, as I mentioned, the director of the Bay Area Science Festival at UC San Francisco, and he's also the co-host of the Inquiring Minds podcast. He has written for multiple media outlets, and he's an incredible science communicator. Very lucky to have him on the show. So without any further ado, here he is, Kishore Hari. Kishore, thank you so much for joining me on Talk Nerdy.
It's a pleasure.
I am so excited. So we literally just met about a week ago at Dragon Con. Was that a week ago?
Yeah, it was a week ago. It feels much less long ago because Dragon Con is a massive blur.
Yeah.
Of just science and costumes and partying, all sorts of stuff.
So this was my first Dragon Con. Are you a Dragon Con pro?
Yeah, I'm up to 2 years, so I think that makes me a professional for sure.
Yeah. You have double the experience as I do.
on that trajectory, I'm going to logarithmically go. How was your first experience at Dragon Con?
It was good. You know, I was there with the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, the other podcast that I work on. They have gone many, many, many years because they are huge sci-fi and fantasy nerds. And I am new to their podcast. I just joined them last year. So this was my initiation. I do not share the same insane joy and love for the world of fantasy and sci-fi geekery. So I am definitely more of an observer when I attend things like this, but I've been to San Diego Comic-Con many times, so I'm sort of seasoned in that world. I wasn't scared, you know what I mean? Dragon Con didn't overwhelm me because I've been to like the mecca of meccas, but I appreciated how friendly and warm it was. I think it was because it's Southern and because it is smaller than SDCC.
It's not as that much smaller than SDCC. I went to both this year, and it was hard not to compare the two, and they're totally different beasts. But, you know, Dragon Con's up at like 80K now.
Really?
And if you add in the parade, it's even more than that. Yeah, it's pretty massive. Like, there's whole probably hotels you didn't even go to.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's really, really big. I mean, San Diego's still a lot bigger, but it's on like the same sort of relative level. as that. It's just in San Diego, you're all together in the same building.
That's true, because there's the conference center, but it has sort of, or the convention center, but it has sort of spilled out to like all the hotels surrounding it. I think the big difference in terms of the vibe and the feels is that San Diego Comic-Con has become, it's sort of gone the way of like South by Southwest, where it's a very industry event now. It's all VIP and crazy long lines. And unless you're there working it, it's like hard to get access to things. And I felt like Dragon Con still felt very fan focused, which I liked.
Yeah, I went to San Diego with Adam Savage this year. I work for his site, tested.com, and I'm part of his sort of entourage. And like, so I worked the con and I got in a lot of places I normally don't get into because I was associated with him. But it was definitely felt still alien. Like there was always a velvet rope to go across. And Dragon Con had a really different experience where I was right up against all of the people that came there because they're science nerds and really wanted to go deep dive into science, which is like totally my jam. Mm-hmm. Like these are my people and there wasn't anything in the way of me interacting and meeting these folks. So in a strange way, I really preferred Dragon Con to San Diego. Even though San Diego is considered the Mecca, it's Dragon Con was just so much more my speed because I really live for these live event experiences where you get to actually engage with real people. I'm going to say something controversial. Mm-hmm. I like people.
What?
I know. It's really controversial.
What kind of a Bay Area resident are you?
I know. It's and in science communication, too, how dare I say I like people?
That's hilarious. Yeah, you know, I had a similar experience at SDCC. It's gotten to the point where I only go, because I'm not really much of a fangirl, I mostly have gone for work. I get hired to go do coverage or to do junket interviews or something like that. And so I go for the paycheck more than anything. I will say I appreciate that I can take the train down there from LA. Like proximity-wise, it's better for me. But it's gotten to the point where even when I get offered jobs at SDCC, I have to really think long and hard about if it's worth it because it's such a shit show and I always get so sick. Whereas I would agree with you. I felt like at Dragon Con, I love that there was that there is a science track, that there is a podcasting track, there's a skepticism track, and I got to do panels on all of those. And you really get to meet people who are fundamentally interested in those things and not just interested in Star Trek and Star Wars. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I like after that is the new not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, the SGU guys made me, we all dressed up as like kind of traditional Star Trek, sort of the, I don't even know what's the first one called, just the regular Star Trek.
The original series.
There you go. It's terrible. In like the full on garb and did our live recording of SGU in the clothes. And I got lots of likes on Instagram for that one.
I believe it.
Did you dress up?
I had three cosplays. So the first day I was on a panel on The Expanse with some folks that work on as science advisors for the show. And I love the show. I love how the Corey twins, as I like to call them, have incorporated hard science into that show.
Yeah.
And so I cosplayed as one of the characters, Alex, for that, who has like a beard. It was not a huge stretch for me. I kind of look the part already. Day two, I got inducted into the Stonecutters, which is like the stonemason group from The Simpsons.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's a deep cut. It was very much a deep cut. So it's from like season six of The Simpsons. So that was probably what, like 1850s, probably is when that episode actually came out. But it was more than 20 years ago. And
holy
so
shit, you're it right.
It separates the olds from the young. So we
Oh,
go,
I for sure remember those episodes.
Yeah, but you can imagine there's a lot of people at that con. That episode is older than they are.
Yeah.
So we walked around, there's a whole song, and like the whole point of that of the Stonecutters is to just be social and drink and have a good time. So we went around singing songs, singing the Stonecutter anthem all night with our like banner and in our robes. And then lastly,
I gotta ask before your last one, wasn't Mr. Burns like somehow really involved in the Stonecutters?
Yes, he was a member of the Stonecutters, but it's a hierarchical group. So everyone's assigned a number by the order they joined.
Oh,
and Mr. Burns joined a lot later than a lot of the members. So he was a low ranking member of the Stonecutters.
Ah, the juxtaposition there. Did you have a Mr. Burns Stonecutter cosplay? Was there anybody that was that old in your crew?
No, but number one was played by Patrick Stewart in the episode. And so we have a number one who kind of has a Patrick Stewart vibe to him. So it all follows. I'm only number 44. So there's not that many of us. Actually, that is a lot of us.
That's a lot.
That is a lot of us. So there's like 20, 30 of us wandering around the con.
Oh, that is so funny. All right, so number three.
Number three is kind of bizarre, is I went as Mayor McCheese from
Oh my God, I saw you, and I didn't know it was you.
Yeah, so that happened quite a bit to a lot of people that was on the science track, is they interacted with me but didn't realize I was in this giant cheeseburger head costume with like finery on. Like I had a 70s prom shirt and a bow tie and a velour jacket. I kind of took it to the nines. Like as I mentioned, I work for Adam Savage and he is cosplay crazy. Like costuming means a ton to him.
Well, and he has to, right? He can't walk the con floor unless he's wearing a mask or he gets like mobbed.
Exactly. And he's made a game out of it. He has these Adam Incognito walks where he just goes around and tries to get through an exhibit hall floor without people recognizing him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's devoted, like his cave where he keeps all of his personal props is like the mecca for me. It has a million different original props that he's built over the years, from like multiple C-3POs down to like a lock of Chewbacca's actual hair. And while he talks about it being a really democratic thing where cosplaying can be for anyone, as long as you sort of inhabit that character and you share your enthusiasm through it, and it doesn't have to be intricate. His stuff is really, really intricate. So it's always been deeply intimidating to work for a guy like that and try to create your own, because I have no craft and skill.
Yeah. Like,
I know statistics and chemistry. So like, and so.
But if you really like are that character, if you own that character, and also if you wear cosplay that's kind of just really creative, I think it can be as impressive, if not more impressive, than like a screen accurate version of something.
Yeah. And so I went as this weird 70s, 80s nostalgic McDonald's character, and I've never high-fived that many people in my life. Well, it was amazing.
You were seriously right behind us when we were all eating dinner at a restaurant. It was the whole Skeptics Guide crew with all their family members and stuff. And you were in the restaurant behind us because we were like, hey, Mayor McCheese, what the fuck? Like, it was crazy. I remember you being right there. And the funny thing is, Evan Bernstein, one of the co-hosts of The Skeptic's Guide, his cosplay was Adam Savage. Because when he grows out his beard and puts on glasses and an Indiana Jones hat, he looks exactly like him.
I was trying to get a picture with Evan in his Adam cosplay, but I couldn't. It's hard to talk through a cheeseburger head, so
sure,
I couldn't
sure,
flag him down.
I love this. World's colliding. So we actually met because you moderated a panel about science communication, and I was one of the panelists. I think I got thrown onto a bunch of panels last minute because nobody at Dragon Con like knew me, because I'd never been before. And so I was meeting everybody for the first time and trying to figure out how I could contribute and how I could help. And you were, first of all, you blew me away as the moderator. You are obviously incredibly comfortable in front of crowds. You asked really great questions. You were really good at sort of rolling with the punches when some of the panelists maybe weren't coming out of their shells or were maybe dominating too much, or even helping the people in the audience become comfortable. I love that you were crouched down in the audience with the microphone most of the time.
I live for that. Actually, my first foray into science communication. I was a scientist for many years. Like, I owned and operated a chemical company that it specialized in environmental remediation of mercury, a product that I developed. It's all very interesting and boring.
No, but also something to be really proud of. Like, as an industry scientist, you can hold your head up high and say, oh, we did mercury remediation. And everybody goes, ooh, that's great. That's good for the planet.
Yeah, I always joke around that it always took me to the most fabulous places. I always was outside of insert city name here.
Oh, you're right. Like, all the places that the planes don't actually land, where you have to like rent a car and drive for 2 hours.
Exactly. But I had a really successful career as a scientist, and I got to this inflection point because I sold the business where I was like, oh, I could do whatever I want. What do I want to do? And I did the most logical thing ever. I went to a scientific conference, which makes no sense whatsoever. And I went to this big meeting, the AAAS conference, which is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And I went to all these symposia, tried to rekindle that sort of love affair I've always had with science. And I saw this flyer on the wall, and it said, come learn about science cafes. And when I saw that sign, I had no idea what a science cafe was. And I was like, oh, they tricked out a cafe to be science themed. I want to go to that. And it happened to be like 2 blocks from my apartment in San Francisco. So I went to this meetup. It was hosted by WGBH and the program Nova. And I was like, oh, this sounds legit.
Yeah.
And I met a bunch of people. There was like neuroscientists there. There was just normal people there. There was locals that frequented that bar cafe that were there. And I couldn't tell you what we talked about that night, but we chatted about science for like 3-4 hours. And it was the best I remember of science, where I would just bullshit with my friends about science topics for hours on end. It was like a return to sort of college life in that way. And I loved how alive that kind of conversation made me. Mm-hmm. And I felt inspired to bring that level of the social aspects of science out to more people. So within a month, I had started my science cafe, where a different researcher would just show up at a cafe and start talking to people and listen to them. And in that sort of cauldron of running an event like that, where you would just randomly run into a scientist at this thing, I got good at talking to people and listening to what they said and working the crowd. It was sort of my version of going through what stand-up comedians go through, where they basically sit there and go to every open mic they can for months and months and months until they start to craft something akin to an act.
Yeah, actually, and you get those hits once in a while, which carry you, because there's a lot of misses. There's a lot of times when you're, you know, trying to talk to somebody about something and they're either not getting it or you're not breaking through somehow. And those are like really good learning opportunities.
Or in my case, a whole year of misses. I felt like I started running these cafes and I had all these researchers, some of them like kind of big name people, come through and it just didn't work because people didn't give a shit about your credentials when you showed up at their local cafe. You were on their turf now.
Yeah, and also for most people, a scientist is just a scientist. Like, most people have never met a scientist. And so it doesn't matter, like, how prolific a scientist or how many publications they have. It's like, oh, you do science? Okay.
Yeah, and it was a wonderful experience because it was the first time in a long time, and I had worked in academia before, that I felt there was an equivalence, because there is this sort of lionization, almost fetishization of certain scientists within the university and research lab structures.
Yeah.
And it felt like we're finally all on the same page to be out somewhere just really democratic and that anyone could access. And I thought that was fascinating to look at, because there were moments when it really clicked and when it really worked. Oftentimes what would be happening is an audience member would have kind of a question or a concern, and the scientist would actually listen to them.
Yeah.
And those moments I lived for. There was one that was you got to stick with me on it a little bit.
Okay. So, okay.
Like, I was probably a couple years into starting to run these live events, and the cafe had gotten so popular that we had to move to a nightclub. And so I was taking over this like nightclub in like the Tech Gulch, the SoMa district of San Francisco, on like a Tuesday night. Mm-hmm. And so it's a nightclub with the lights turned on, which is not a pretty sight, I'll just say.
Do nightclubs have fluorescent lights like above all of the nightclubby lights?
Yeah. How do you think they kick people out at the end of the night?
I don't know. It's been a long time since I've been to a nightclub.
Yeah. I'm lucky if I make it to like 10 o'clock on a weeknight now. But, you know, we're hosting this thing in a nightclub because they're big open spaces with good AV. And so I'm in there and I was like, I should take a risk. I live in San Francisco. It's kind of a science-minded area. I should try to, you know, branch out and do things that I don't consider like mainstream science. And I met a researcher at Stanford who'd been working on mindfulness and putting people through fMRI and studying the impacts of mindfulness on them long term, both using cognitive behavioral therapy and actually a combination of fMRIs. It was legit. You know, you may quibble with some of the interpretations of the findings, but there was legit science happening.
Yeah.
And so I put him on stage to talk about what we know about the science of meditation. And like 300 some people showed up. We had to turn 100 people away.
Wow.
And this is like nightclub down like a back alley too. It was like, it was totally funky and weird. And I'll never forget, a woman stands up in the audience kind of after about like an hour and a half. And she's like, her hand is trembling as she takes the microphone. And she starts talking about how for her life, she has been unhappy and depressed and suicidal, and mindfulness made a difference to her. And she just wants to know why. And she wants answers. And she's crying. The audience goes dead silent. I remember I couldn't move. I was frozen standing, you know, a foot away from her. And I just remember the scientists sitting there and just listening to her and how much that ended up meaning to her. Because I talked to her years later, just randomly. And she talked about that meaning something deeply to her. But moreover, it meant something to me. It meant like something that where it was a hobby for a long time where I was like, oh, I should run this thing in my spare time to get scientists more out in the public. That's when I was like, oh, I want to make this a career. There's something here. There's something powerful when you bring these groups together and give them an opportunity to talk to each other and not at each other in a way that is hard to do in other mediums. And that set me forth into a real career in science communication.
So do you mind my asking what year it was when you were at that AAAS conference and first saw that flyer?
I want to say it was the 2007, it might have been 2008 conference in San Francisco.
So I, in talking to a lot of my friends who also are full-time science communicators like yourself, like myself, and kind of our networks, I find a similar origin story for a lot of people that they discovered a group, and once they sort of hung with that group, they felt really inspired in a way that they hadn't been in a very long time. For me, it was Science Online, those conferences that used to happen on the East Coast that were all about pulling together a lot of science communicators online. And I had an experience, and I'm wondering if yours was similar, where when you first started doing it and you first started trying to make a career of it, you didn't realize how many other people were also working very hard at this.
No idea. The idea of science communication even being a quote-unquote career, not even remotely in my sphere. Like, I knew there were science writers at newspapers.
Yeah.
Like I knew who Carl Zimmer was. But outside of that, like, outside of, like, those handful of people, and science blogging was taking off at this time, so I knew a few names here and there, but nothing remotely a career. And the other thing is, for the most part, most of science communication that I was aware of was all in writing. And that's just not what I was interested in. So, but there's a whole world of science communication that goes well beyond your traditional journalism jobs that have appeared especially in the last, it feels like in the last decade, it's really grown.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the last decade, it's taken off, or at least it's become legitimized in a way that I meet young scientists or young graduate students in the sciences, and they tell me about workshops that they take in SciComm, or they tell me about tracks within their majors that are SciComm focused. And I'm like, no fair. Like, no. We did not have that when I was in school.
So I have a university job now, and I have at least two lunches, two coffees a week with students that are all they want to do is talk to me about how they get out of academia and go into science communication.
Yeah.
And there's more and more recognition on a national level, especially with some NIH subcommittees now that are talking about, we are telling most of our scientists that lies, because only, you know, depending on how you count, 20 to 30% of them actually go into academia. That leaves a huge swath of PhD graduates like that aren't going to go into science in the traditional way that they're trained for. So what do you do with them?
And yeah, because you don't give them career training in academia. That's something people don't realize, right? A traditional academic track is fully focused on producing more academics. There's no training whatsoever for most people in doing non-traditional things like SciComm, or even like becoming an industry person. Like, you don't get business skills training. You don't get training in how to write a resume. All you know how to write is a CV. There's just, it's a very insular experience for a lot of people.
That's really changing now. Like, the NIH requires all grad students and postdocs that are funded, all principal investigators are funded by research training grants to have their students and postdocs go through what's called IPD, which is individual, I don't even know what it stands for. I don't know.
It's like preparation, or yeah, it's like basically preparation.
It's like a career plan. Everyone That's has awesome. To make a career plan now. And you know, now that we're seeing more and more of this, more universities are recognizing they have to invest in resources for career counseling and training, in especially in other genres. So the university I work at, the University of California, San Francisco, even developed an internship program where they literally get you internships outside of your field of science, but with the idea that you're bringing a lot to the table as a scientist in terms of your training. So you tends to be a lot of people good with statistics in that way. There tends to be a lot of people that have practice in writing. So the internships range from like media companies to like Uber. One of my good friends, while in between doing his like PhD and postdoc, he went and developed algorithms for Uber to track where cars were, because he was a neuroscientist and he'd munch data all day.
That's so great. I have that too. Like, most of my friends that have PhDs are either science writers. I have a friend who's in a writing room on a television show. I have friends who consult for startup companies. You know, like, most of my PhD friends don't actually work in academia.
Yeah, you're friends with the right people then.
Yeah. And that's really our core group here in LA. Like, we have a great, we call ourselves the Nerd Brigade. We have a great group of friends who are all very pro-science, very pro-SciComm, and we make it our lives. Our kind of careers have spilled over into our sort of non-professional lives as well, which we really love, because how do you not eat, breathe, and live science when you are trained as a scientist and you just love science? It becomes your lifestyle in a way.
And even though you mentioned that there's so much more than there was like 10 years ago for us, there's these training programs. There's still not a lot out there. Like, you still have to beg, scratch, and steal your way to certain jobs and certain careers. So there is a ton of value in working with all of these groups.
For sure. Like, a lot of people, like myself included, are freelancers in SciComm, which means you're figuring out your way. You're figuring out how to get paid enough to be like a normal salary if you were working for a company. And, you know, I have two friends, Jason Goldman, who's been on the show before, and Sarah Curtis, who I still haven't had on the show, which is weird. And we dreamed up 2 years ago. We realized there's not conferences. There's not a lot of opportunities for SciCommers to get together and learn from one another in a kind of relaxed way. And so we were like, let's make one. And at first it was kind of silly, but then we said, fuck it. And we did one last year, and we're on year two. So in November, SciComm Camp 2 is happening here in Malibu. And it's really cool to see the spread of like very early career psycommerce, like undergrads and grad students who have a blog and are starting to figure out what they want to do with this, all the way up to public information officers at universities or people who have appointments at NASA who are really interested in sharing science with, quote unquote, the public. I know you hate that.
I don't like really the term. Great. For really the great. Listeners, I don't like the term general public because I've yet to meet general public.
John P. Q. public man.
And when you go into like all sorts of communication research, you realize there's lots of publics out there, and talking about them in a more specific way, especially when you're talking about them in an academic setting, is worth it. Okay. Now
so,
I'm off my soapbox.
No, I like your soapbox. I want to dig deeper into your soapbox. What do you say when you are in a position where you have to speak more generally about an audience that maybe is not yet defined, or an audience that potentially doesn't have parameters around it?
So I do my best to define the audience that's there. I mean, and like anyone, like you always take your best shots. There's always these mishmashes. There's going to be some percentage of the audience that aren't encapsulated by who you're referring to. But I run a big science festival right now, and like, you know, close to 100,000 people come to it. Mm-hmm. And I could describe that 100,000 people as the audience for the festival, but that's not really useful because
it's
like,
kind of circular, right?
Yeah, it's like 50, there's like 50 events during this festival, and like, a lot of them are families. So I talk about, I break down our audience by geography, when they're families, the, you know, rough age range of the kids that we know. And then there's a whole set of events that really cater to like a 21 plus crowd. So I do my best to segment that mostly by age, but we've done it by household income as well. And sometimes I ascribe names to them, funny names that make me chuckle at night in internal reports. But mostly I do it because those different audiences come with very different reasons and goals to the science events. So I think I do them a disservice if I lump them all together.
Well, and you do the actual communication a disservice, because if we as communicators aren't defining who we're actually communicating with, then we might be speaking the wrong language.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's my soapbox moment for this
podcast. Like it, but it led me into, let's talk about the festival, because I know people listening right now are like, I could be one of 100,000 people coming to this awesome thing. Why don't you let the people who are listening know a little more about it?
So 6 years ago, after following the logic train of running a science cafe and meeting all sorts of people that do interesting science stuff, I fell into this opportunity to start a science festival. And the idea has been long ranging in like Europe and other in Asia, where it's like, if we want science to be part of culture, or we think it's a part of culture, then we should celebrate it as if it was a part of culture in the way that many communities do. And so San Francisco, where I live, has a strong festival-going culture. Like, any weekend you go out, there's a festival of something. A festival of food trucks. A festival of running. A festival of whatever Beta Breakers is, which is this big costumed race through the city. Starting a science festival was a bit of putting a foot in the ground, being like, science is an important part of the fabric of the San Francisco Bay Area, which it clearly is. And so it annually happens in the San Francisco summertime, which is the end of October. For anyone that has been to San Francisco, they know that to be true, that October is the nicest month of the year in terms of the weather. And this year it runs from October 27th to November 5th. And really my goal is sort of twofold. It's one, that everyone that comes to the festival has a direct interaction with a scientist, engineer, or some sort of science professional of some sort. So no matter if you're at an event, a big hands-on science event in a baseball stadium, to a quiet storytelling event in some random small music club in the corner of town, you'll have the opportunity to talk and interact with scientists for real. And so in that vein, what I try to do is create a festival that has two strands. One that's really free and devoted to families that have kids age 5 to 14. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it's free is that it creates a level of equity and access that isn't available for a lot of other arenas. If you go to a science museum here, it's usually about $30 a person.
Yeah.
So I wanted to create something that was a little bit more democratic, that everyone from like the universities to the research labs, the science museums, to the after-school program could participate in under one flag. And we do them in non-traditional science locations. So we take over where the San Francisco Giants play baseball and do a big hands-on day there. We do one geographically up in wine country, where there's a much different demographic, especially ethnically speaking. Mm-hmm. We do one in the East Bay because bridges make people not want to come to your event. And so we're trying to really bring science to where people live with these hands-on days. And then we do events in the evening for adults, and I try to be a little bit experimental and weird. So we've had like a science pub crawl through the Mission District of San Francisco, where like every storefront would have a science activity related to what they do. We partnered with a friend of mine, Zach Wienersmith, who is the webcomic artist behind Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. Mm-hmm. And he started an event called BaFest, which is six scientists give a total bullshit theory around science in front of a huge crowd. And it's one of our most popular events. It fills up like a 2,000-seat theater to have scientists come just give bullshit explanations, like a theory from anything. And so I try to mix in a variety of things. Like, you're hard-pressed to find a PowerPoint presentation during my festival. And I'm really proud of that.
Yeah.
I want people to get out and experience science where things could never happen. There's one event, though, I have to say. So the website's BayAreaScience.org. Go there. You'll see everything that's going on.
Cool. So people can literally just keep up with the calendar, go to the things they want to go to, skip the things they don't want to go to, and just be engaged if and when they can.
Yep, exactly.
I love that. It just becomes a part of like your normal routine during that week.
I will say there's one event I've always wanted to do and never been able to get to happen. And I want your feedback.
Okay.
This is a good idea.
Are you doing it this year?
I am not.
You haven't been able to get it to happen.
I haven't been able to get it to happen. So I take like Ubers and Lyfts a lot of places. It's really convenient in the city. You do too?
Yeah. I don't really Lyft. And I think it's the holdover of like, do they still make you DAP? You know, like I remember when I first learned about that and was like, nope, never doing that. But I do Uber everywhere.
So, you know how like Uber sometimes will run special promotions where it's like order a cat, like kittens will come, or order an ice cream truck. So I talked to like some people at Uber a long time ago about this idea and they okayed it and it ended up not working out. The idea that you could order a scientist.
That's awesome.
And like, so you'd get in a car and like somebody would be there and be like, hey, I'm a neuroscientist. Do you have a question about the brain? And so as you went from point A to point B, you had an opportunity to actually hear. But the beauty of it, the why I so wanted to do it, is that it puts the scientist on kind of like the other foot. Now, all they get to say is like, hey, I'm a this. Do you have any questions? And they have to like sit there and like, you know, talk to people. People that have opted in. But I just love the frame of it, because it's really scientists just like coming out and meeting you where you live.
No, I think it's genius. I wonder how you will bribe the scientists to do this.
Oh, no. It's the other way. So,
oh, really? You're afraid that people won't order a scientist? I know they will.
So I've had no trouble getting scientists interested in doing this. I mean, they only want to do it for a couple hours. And
yeah, that's pretty much all you could handle. And like, I feel like you would need to make sure that nobody was ordering you in like a weird dark alley.
No, and like the idea is we'd restrict the geographic area. We'd make sure it was safe. All of those things that you have to go through.
Yeah.
But the concept of it, of just going out and meeting a stranger, and that stranger happens to be a scientist, and striking up a conversation with them, there's something deeply old school about that to me, like a callback to the old, you know, public saloons or public houses from England that I want to recreate in a modern setting.
Well, and it kind of reminds me about like when you would call your doctor and they would come to your house. Like, that's so cool, this idea that like, I'm going to meet you where you are instead of hanging out in this ivory tower and you kind of trying to get to me somehow.
Yeah.
I love that.
I deeply believe, and there's lots of examples of science festivals and science activities and science groups really doing what I call just add science, where they like intermingle with where people are meeting and congregating already. And so that science just becomes part of like a larger framework of what's going on. And in that way, it's more natural. It's more accessible and it's more approachable. And that's what I sort of live for, is interactions that can thrive in that type of environment. Okay, so I'm not crazy. So I got to.
No, you're not crazy, but I do have one other concern.
Okay, let's hear it.
So tell me if this happens to you a lot, because I've heard echoes of this from a lot of my friends, and I get this too. Kids sending you messages via Facebook or whatever your portals are where people can reach you, basically in a veiled way, asking for you to help them with their homework.
Oh, all the time.
So how are you going to prevent a kid from just ordering a scientist and being like, I'm confused about my chemistry work?
Well, I'm going to use the approach of having this at night. So hopefully that'll limit some kids, like early evening, but not like prime time, for, like after school. There's no way to totally prevent that.
Funny that they're so socially savvy? Like they totally hack the system. They're like, oh, you know stuff. Can you help me with this problem? And it's like, no, dude.
Though every now and
again. Your own damn homework.
Every now and again, I get questions. I mean, assuredly, I get questions outside of my field of expertise in science. No question.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone gets that. Sometimes I get really sophisticated questions, and those are the ones I respond to just because I'm kind of mildly impressed.
Mm-hmm. for sure.
But I never respond to those because it's so bizarre and weird. And so I have a university post, so I get them through my university. I have a science podcast, so I get them through my podcast. And then I do these science videos for Tested for Adam Savage's site, and I get them through that. So I get like the triple dose.
It's so obvious too. And they always try to, well, sometimes they don't try to veil it, but usually they try to veil it. And it's like, you know, I was just curious if a train leaves Baltimore. And you're like, no.
I get a lot of worse emails.
Trust me. Yeah, we know. So you were talking about your university post now. You were in academia, you went into industry. When you were ready to leave industry, you started doing SciComm on your own with the cafes. It grew into something bigger. What made you want to go kind of back to the university? And what is your post? Because you keep saying you have a post. Are you teaching or is it more in an administrative capacity?
So I the science festival I run is based out of a university, and I work in a K-12 outreach department there, and I have an academic post there. So we both like publish works and organize outreach for the entire university mostly around K-12 activities, but also now in informal settings. So it's a mix, and now most of my work there has become sort of behind the scenes, like working on science policy and science agendas, working with different foundations and federal agencies. So I get to go to DC a lot. That's what that means.
Do you spend like all your time in the Smithsonian when you're not working? Because I do. When I'm in DC, I like lose my mind. I'm obsessed with the Natural History Museum there. It's so good.
No, my sister lives there, so I spend time with my family.
Oh, okay.
That's way better.
All right.
Hockey games.
Yeah, you won't find me at one of those. When you said that you you publish works, are you doing research? Are you investigating science communication outcomes, or are you writing things like curriculum and policy?
No, it's more along the lines of what you would associate with research. Like science communication research is a burgeoning field.
So cool.
And it's really poorly named. So for our audience, it's called the science of science communication often, which is like the worst name ever.
Well, it is the worst name ever, but it's sort of a logical extension of the way that we already talk in academia. Like it makes sense. It just doesn't have a ring to it.
Yeah, I have a problem because it doesn't have a ring to it.
I have never done any scientific investigation into science communication except in a reporting capacity, you know, trying to cover things journalistically. I did used to do science. Oh my God, you can tell we're podcasting late at night. I moderated a couple of days at the National Academies of Sciences in DC a few years ago when they did a Sackler colloquium on they called it the science of science communication.
That's one of the big annual meetings around that.
Mm-hmm. And it was really cool to see. I mean, it was hard as a moderator. because it was very traditional in the most rigid academic way possible. Talk about PowerPoints and trying to push through and get people off of their PowerPoints. But it was cool to see this attempt, this movement towards quantifying science communication, actually trying to look at real outcomes of it and make sure we're not just blowing smoke, that we're actually trying to do something that has a real effect.
Most of the work that I've been exposed to that I know of is nascent for the most part. And it largely has been focused on communication through mass media in different ways.
Sure.
But now we have all these kind of burgeoning areas of SciComm, whether it's through social channels or through live events, where there's millions of people engaging in these platforms, if not hundreds of millions around the world. But we really haven't studied them much. And behind the scenes, what's happening is there's a lot of foundations, including the National Science Foundation, that's focused on adding capacity to this whole research arena, because oftentimes we are missing mega opportunities by trying to understand these. So I work on one project called, it's really poorly called, EvalFest. And it's basically, can we figure out what's going on when people go to science festivals and other live science events? And create common tools for all of these disparate groups from across the country to do so. Mm-hmm. And in the first year of this project, we're able to collect something like 10 to 15,000 surveys of people coming to these events. That in and of itself would be one of the largest surveys of attitudes towards science in the United States ever done. And it's sort of this strange position where we don't really know a lot about how people think and approach science in the U.S. outside of some basic Pew research studies, whereas in the U.K. there's much more defined infrastructure to do so. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of investment in this area, though it is in its early stages.
Interesting. Yeah, that's exciting. And, you know, it's cool to see somebody who is both a practitioner of science communication also trying to I don't know, what would be the right word? I'm trying to think. There's like a psychology term, like to introspect, to sort of take what you're doing anyway and actually turn your eyes in to see its efficacy. I think that's it's a very sort of noble cause, and it's one that I would love to be more involved in as it starts to develop more.
Noble cause is code word for, wow, that's crazy. Why are you doing that?
That's like, you're not going to win any awards anytime soon.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think it is really cool, and it's really important because it's such a new field, right? We just talked about how SciComm has become huge over the past decade or so. It's sort of like with any new field, you think back to sort of barber surgeons. Just you would do shit because you think it might work, and you're really trying to push the boundaries and make a difference and have an impact. But when you don't have any data, you don't have any quantification of that, you might be way off. And it's important to see those outcomes.
Yeah, and we also don't need to, you know, relearn how to make the wheel. You hear a lot of really famous science communicators like Neil Tyson talk about how he studies stand-up comics. Mm-hmm. And he does that with reason, because there are all these areas of expertise, knowledge bases developed outside of science that we can import to great effect. And that's been done really well for people in your area of expertise, like in terms of science communication in the public eye, whether it's mass media or writing. But we don't see that as much in some of the other utilizations. So like, you go to a lot of live science events, a lot of them are really bad. and they miss some like really basic parameters that that people that regularly run events kind of know what the deal is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's like basic things about keeping the audience interested, making sure that there's comedy, making sure everybody's lubricated. Like, there are definitely important aspects. I see it a lot when it comes to science, like you said, in mass media, especially science in scripted and unscripted television or in film, where you have sometimes scientists who will come on as consultants, who will get frustrated at the beginning because they'll be like, that's incorrect. And why are you trying to make sure the story does this? The science says it should do that. And it's like, no. The science is in service to the story. It's not the other way around. And we have to remember that in entertainment. And I think that it's important to see that happening across the board when it comes to communicating science. It doesn't matter if nobody's listening to you. And the best way to be able to have that sort of engagement is to tell stories.
I totally agree. Here's the thing that keeps me up at night. So I...
How did you know? Do you know I close my my podcast asking people that? But we will get to that again later. Well, tell me what keeps you up at night.
Well, I'll tell you something else that keeps me up at
okay,
night
good,
later.
Okay, good, good.
So one of the things that does keep me up at night is I consume a lot of science stuff. Like I go to a lot of science events. I consume a lot of science-based media. But I have this sense that there's really, really interesting stuff going on there that we that revolves a little bit around science, but we don't know much about it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a bias in SciComm to urban cities, particularly in the U.S. And I think that bias basically leaves us blind to what is happening in all sorts of small communities and interesting pockets around the country. If not around the world. And so I really, really want to ferret out weird stuff. Like we were just at a big comic convention while it was in Atlanta, which is a big urban center. Like that was weird that there is people that came to that con specifically to come to the science track. They have loyal fans.
Oh yeah. That room was packed and there were people with amazing questions.
And we are not in... We're not in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're not in New York. We're not in San Francisco. We're in Atlanta. Like, it's a different spot. And I think there's something about how does that all get created that I want to capture and share with a lot more people. My end goal is not to be ever front of camera because I have a face for radio.
First of all, I completely disagree. And second of all, I think you would be great in front of camera because you're very charismatic.
Well, that's nice of you to say.
And I'm not saying it to be nice. There are so many people who are working very hard to be in front of the camera who should not be in front of the camera. It has nothing to do with what you look like. It has absolutely everything to do with your comfort level and how much you connect with the audience. And I heavily, like, I was actually very impressed when we first met in person and you were moderating that panel because you got it. And not everybody in that track, not everybody in that room, and not everybody on stage in many of these situations get it.
That's incredibly generous of you to say. I deeply appreciate it. And you should have seen me when I started. I was not like that at all.
I think that was a piece of advice that I gave people when they were asking about, like, how do you get started and how do you know if you're doing better? And I was like, you know you're doing well in SciComm when you're embarrassed to look at early tape.
Yeah, that resonated strong. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I will not watch or listen to when I started out, because it's hard to listen to yourself back then.
It's hard to listen to yourself now. It's especially hard to listen to yourself from years ago.
So I force myself to listen to myself now because that's the only way to get better is to really practice. And a friend of mine, Anthony Carboni, used to host a science show on the Weather Channel, like sent out this information on like how to make a better podcast. And it was very much like, listen to yourself. You know, the self that you want to hear, be that. Stop being anything else. Get better, noob. And I was like, oh, that's advice I can live by. And so I try to embody that with a lot of the content that I bring.
That's awesome that you do that, because that's my biggest struggle in every approach to media, whether I'm in front of the camera, whether I'm, you know, in front of the microphone. It's first of all, it takes so much freaking time. It's like you sit there and you do a full hour podcast. We're podcasting for an hour and it's so much fun and it's so engaging. The second time around, the third time around, you're like, do I need to listen to myself over and over? And same thing on camera. It's cringeworthy for me to watch myself on camera. So I do it seldom. I should do it much more. I have shows saved in my DVR with the intention of doing it, but I really feel like unless my producer is sitting next to me, almost like a football player with his coach, it's very hard to take the time to just watch. And you almost, unless you're guided, have a hard time going, oh, this was good, that could be better. And instead you just go, oh, what horrible drivel. I can't believe I said that.
Well, just because we're friends and you got to stick together in SciComm, I won't listen to this podcast.
No. No, you have to. It's so good.
Okay.
So we haven't talked about your podcast.
Yeah, I host a podcast for Mother Jones called Inquiring Minds. My co-host, Indre Viscontis, was on this podcast, I think last year, maybe?
Yeah, she was one of my earlier guests. And were you on Inquiring Minds then, or was she still with Chris Mooney?
I think when she was on your show, I had switched over. Chris started hosting the show, but I think he left around like episode 50 or 60.
Yeah, he left before he went to Washington Post, I think.
Yeah, yeah. He definitely left then. And so now we're up to like 150 now.
Oh, that's great. That's huge. This is going to be episode 126.
Oh, nice. Look
at you. Isn't that exciting?
Catching up.
Catching up, but probably will never. Are you guys weekly?
We're weekly, and we try to be like fresh air meets science. Unfiltered conversations with scientists. And, you know, a lot of times we're talking to science authors or science communicators. But for the most part, I want people to access voices that they just don't get to hear more than a couple minutes on NPR or some other locations, where we can really get into the science a little bit more. And sometimes that's great, sometimes it's not.
So I can edit this if necessary. Is Inquiring Minds still associated with the Center for Inquiry, or is it just with Mother Jones now?
So it was called, Chris and Indre started a podcast called Point of Inquiry that was part of Center for Inquiry.
I'm mixing
and
that
then
up.
They left CFI to join Mother Jones and renamed the podcast Inquiring Minds.
Gotcha. Okay. So it's been an evolution of sorts, and now it's much more focused on pure science, not on sort of skepticism, atheism, and those topics as well.
Yeah, it's not a skeptics podcast for sure, but I wouldn't call it a pure science podcast either. Our tagline is the intersection of science, politics, and society. So we cover a lot of interesting things. Like next week, we have on Representative Jackie Speier. And a victim of sexual harassment in science, one of Jeff Marcy's victims, actually, talking about sexual harassment in science. That's not something you would necessarily think you would hear on a pure science show.
Yeah.
But we think it's important to cover because it's an emerging crisis that has been part of the huge news mix over the past year.
Yeah, I think it's important that people have an unexpected exposure a little bit. You know, on Skeptics Guide, we stay away from politics because we are a skeptic podcast, actually probably more of a science podcast than a skeptic podcast. It's a science podcast with a skeptical bent. But we stay away from politics completely because it's just very contentious and it's very hard for a lot of people to keep a skeptical hat on when it comes to the emotion that we see in politics. Yet on this podcast, on Talk Nerdy, I love talking politics because it matters. I think it's something that's important.
It totally matters. We had on a guest last week, the science writer Dave Levitan, who's has a forthcoming book out called Not a Scientist, where he details the origin of politicians, particularly Republicans, using that phrase over and over again. I'm not a scientist,
but the earth is 6,000 years old.
And you can say what you want for being fair and skeptical. We're in the middle of a deeply tense election cycle right now where science has basically given short shrift. Like it has zero coverage in the election cycle. And so while I've received lots of interesting messages, let's say, about that episode, I'm going to continue to do it because I think it's in the interest of our listeners to discuss some of these topics. You know, we had a former SeaWorld trainer on who was featured in Blackfish. That was an awful show to try to record because it's just heartbreaking to hear those tales and try to be sort of fair and skeptical that this person is not just an employee that's angry at their former employer. So there's balances to strike. And so while none of those that I've described are pure science topics, I think they're important for listeners to hear. And I'm going to keep challenging our listener pool there too. While still, we're still going to talk about LIGO and all sorts of great scientific discoveries because I'm a science nerd too.
I love it. So when do you sleep?
I get in some hours.
Some of them.
Sometimes.
Like, do you take vacations?
I do. Like, I mean, like, there's this thing right now because I run a science video series for Tested and I have a podcast and I run a festival. It's all probably a bit too much. And but at the same time, it's what I live for. Like I couldn't imagine, you know, 10 year ago me thinking that this is where I'd be now. Because he was sort of aimless and was looking for any sort of inspiration. And so I think he'd be jealous that these opportunities have sort of emerged for me. And I try to remain sort of humble and appreciative that all of this came. So even though I sacrifice like sleep and certain recreation time, it's because I just really, really love what I do. That being said, I still find time to take vacation and get out there. You make worse science communication if you don't.
That's true. I mean, it's a complicated thing. You know, one of the sessions, the breakout sessions that were kind of user-generated, camper-generated last year at our first SciComm camp was about work-life balance. And it was, I think, one of the more popular sessions, and it really spoke to me personally. I think it's something a lot of us struggle with, especially freelancers. You are a prime example of somebody who's like almost a full-time freelancer on top of having a full-time academic position, which is cray cray. Like, you do what I do and then you have an academic position. And I've been thinking about going back to school to finally like finish the PhD, and I'm going to be diving into that again, you know, doing that on top of trying to maintain doing a lot of the work that I do. And I don't know if I'm going to be very good at work-life balance. I think it's something a lot of people struggle with, both in and outside of this sort of industry.
For me, and I would talk about this with my wife, like I was used to running this like monthly event where, you know, 100, 200 people would come and interact with a scientist, and I would really come out on a sort of like performance high after that. Mm. And I would come home and it would keep me going. And now that I run a festival, which is this once a year thing, there are these 11 other months that happen where I'm planning for this one big thing, but I never get that sort of experience of being uplifted. And that's why I dove into the podcast, because I couldn't stand not having more and more conversations with scientists. I could physically feel that void where I just wasn't happy. And that, if that makes me sound like a crazy person, it's because I am kind of a crazy person. And so that's why I do it, is not so much for any sort of external glory. I mean, I have an ego like everyone else. I do it for that. But I really do it because it brings me personal fulfillment. But I'm also cognizant of the fact that what I want to see this community be longer term is I want to see more people do this, and I want them to do it with better quality than where we are now. I don't want to look back 10 years from now and say like, oh, we missed that STEM train when everyone was talking about STEM and we didn't professionalize in a way that we could have. So I'm definitely looking for how do I increase capacity all around. And if that means I'm involved, great. If it means other folks that are more talented and have more drive and more time to do it, even better.
I love it. I love that. And I love that it really does help pave a way so that not only are more people going to go into SciComm and they're going to be prepared, they're not going to be starting at square one like so many early science communicators, just like we talked about, that experience of like, oh, I'm like the only one who does this, right? And then you realize, oh, no. There are a lot of people who do this and they do it way better than I do. Going in with that knowledge is just so incredibly important so that we're not reinventing the wheel.
If you want to see this in action, the most uplifting conference, SciComm conference I've been to in the past year was something called ComSciCon, which is a graduate student organized science communication conference that usually happens in Cambridge. And I went this year, and the graduate students that participate have to apply to be in. They have to demonstrate a portfolio of stuff. And so I went to their poster session, quote unquote, and I met some of the most creative, interesting folks that I've ever met at a science communication conference, because they weren't burdened with what has gone on before. And I think that level of creativity that newcomers to this field, whether they're coming up through the academic ranks or people that just are interested in science, want to see something interesting created, that's where I think the future of science communication really lies. I think the old stalwarts, like the oldies like us,
yeah,
I think we're destined to get outclassed, because that's the way it should be.
We'll just be hanging out on the sidelines in the stonecutter costumes, man. Well, Kishore, I'm going to thank you for joining me, but I'm not going to let you go yet, because before I close every podcast, I ask the same two questions of my friends, and I'm interested to hear your answers to those questions. You ready?
Yeah, shoot.
All right. So when you think about the future in whatever context, you know, that matters to you, whether it's a personal thing, whether it's a big global, big picture thing, I want to know, A, what is the thing that keeps you up most at night? What are you most preoccupied with or concerned about? And on the flip side of that, what are you most excited and hopeful for?
So the thing that keeps me up at night that's different than the other thing that kept me up at night earlier.
And all of the other things that keep you up at night.
The one that really keeps me up at night is that that for science communication, particularly live events, which is the place where I really specialize and am interested in, that we aren't learning from each other, and that all of the work that has gone into creating these is going to evaporate. Mm-hmm. And 10 years from now, we'll look back and see that we had this moment because STEM was such in the ether. We had a president that would talk about STEM. We had companies talking about STEM. We had funders talking about STEM. And we didn't fully take advantage of that moment in terms of really bringing people together under the banner of science in ways they had never seen before. Now, the reason I'm hopeful is that I think there's a lot of evidence that that is not the case. And what I really want to see, the thing I really most want to create, is I want inside of a university, a center for public science engagement to come around, that it becomes an actual field of study, what we do, how we get people to come together and engage in science, and how science can actually listen to these people in meaningful ways, and have that be such an amazing field that people research it, study it, publish it, and craft new and exciting innovations on it that are driven from academia and the outside world.
Oh my God, I'm really hopeful now too. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and I think inspiring a lot of up-and-coming science communicators who actually listen to the podcast, and maybe informing those who, you know, aren't necessarily interested in SciComm, at least not as a career, in what it's really all about and why it matters. So thank you so much for joining me this week.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thanks, Kara.
And before you go, why don't you let everybody know one more time how they can bother you on the internet?
If you have a question about your homework, you can find me on Twitter at ScienceQuiche, Q-U-I-C-H-E. My podcast is Inquiring Minds, which is at motherjones.com/inquiringminds. Tested.com for my science videos, and BayAreaScience.org for the Bay Area Science Festival.
All of the places, guys, hit him up. And thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.